mentioned about feeling as if you've been on a spiritual path since childhood.
Yeah, that's why I said birth.
Yeah, since birth.
I came in, you know, I think people can sort of, you know, I want to talk about my story in a way that's receivable. And when I say things that may sound fantastic, I'd appreciate like just suspending the disbelief and say it may be possible that this is real for me anyway. And I have early memories of things like the baptism in the church and how that made me feel. And then I remember questioning early and in Bible classes in the church. It was Episcopalian. And they would send the kids off while the sermon went on, and we would have Bible class, and I was a little too precocious, and I would ask questions. I wanted to know what Trinity was. What is that? You know, you're too young to understand. And, I mean, eventually I realized that my young mind was saying, no, you just can't explain it to me. I need to find out somewhere else. That's why I say it that way, because there was something that was looking. And, as soon as I got confirmed Episcopalian, I left and I asked my mom if I could go to the synagogue with my Jewish friend from school because it was not happening there.
Yeah.
And that was interesting. And I did that for a while. I mean, my mom was, this was in Oklahoma, mind you, in the 50s, Tulsa. My mom was way ahead of her time and she eventually found her expression into Unitarian Universalism, which is right along the lines of integral yoga, ecumenism. And I attended some of those churches' sermons in New York when I moved there. But all along, I mean, even in grade school and high school, then by the time I'm in high school, I'm reading the existentialist writers like Kierkegaard and Kafka and Schopenhauer, and that's what I was interested in. Not that I could particularly understand it all, but that was propelling a psychological aspect. It wasn't satisfying this spiritual yearning, particularly. So I went through all these books that my mom had on different religions. I read through a lot of them, trying to find out what they all were about. It was like an encyclopedia of world religions, these major books. And she set me on a good path because she allowed all this. That's why I say Adi Guru. She said, I know you're going to go experience a lot of things in life. Just please remember moderation.
Yeah.
Because I was already going to be influenced by the hippie era and what was happening musically. And in rock and roll was where I was starting to find some inspiration. Actually, the Beatles were a great inspiration spiritually all through those years, the early years. But there were all these other mixed messages coming in with that music.
You remember being confused about that?
No. I remember being inspired by it because it was such a change in the times. I was right on board with, you know, the idealism of that hippie era. I mean, we really, and I'm right past, I was like, 12 or something when Woodstock happened. I would have gone, but I wasn't allowed, you know, so that's the influence. And, yeah. Then eventually, I mean, if we want to just come up to here, I started traveling, was really good, traveling around the world. I got perspective from being way far away. And then I was talking to my sister one year about, you know, some plans that she had coming up for travel. And she said, oh, I don't know. There's this thing with Deepak Chopra in India. I've never been to India. And I was like, yeah, we should go. You should go. I want to go. Let's go. Somehow I was right on board with it. And then he kind of became my teacher for about 2 or 3 years as I went through a lot of what he was offering. in a couple of different modules. There was that one, there was another one in India, and there was one time I went out to his place in La Jolla. And, you know, I got to talk to him a little bit. I actually will admit that I got my first mantra, which was a mantra diksha from him Ayurvedically. So he had done some research for the people that wanted it in this group and gave us a mantra, which I started using for about 3 years before I came to change my careers and came to yoga and found my way to integral yoga. And by then I was not looking for a guru. See, Deepak wasn't my first spiritual teacher. My first spiritual teacher after my mother was, I forgot this part, Terry Cole Whitaker. And she was like a televangelist of the New Age before it was called the New Age. And she came on and she was a Christian minister in San Diego, broadcasting on Sunday mornings when the evangelist hours were in the middle of that, like 11 a.m. on Sunday. And she was very, very popular, very put together, very funny. She had blonde hair. She was gorgeous and very well-spoken and funny, kind of like Gurudev represented. These teachings were coming from India and Christianity. So she was melding the things, and we got some of that from her. And then I got closer to her once she left her big organization and started doing what turned out to be the world's first kind of organized spiritual tours by these current spiritual teachers. Like, everybody learned to do it pretty quickly, but she was one of the first people to take a few people to the pyramids. We went to Egypt and we went to Bali. I went to Bali with her. And then Deepak. But I asked Terry, I said, where's my guru? You know, you had one, where's mine? And she gave me the standard answer, you know, which is when you're ready, you find it. And if not, because the guru is external to take you to the internal, work on that. We all have. Can you find your way to the internal conscience that means?
So she was saying you could, like, you don't need to wait for this aspect of working on the internal.
If one doesn't have an external guru in this lifetime, as I was asking her, where's mine?
Mm-hmm.
If one doesn't find that, it doesn't mean that you can't in this lifetime. And her answer to me was, if you don't, then you have this inside, you know, if you can find your way there. In other words, trust it. Examine that. Can I? And it made sense to me instantly.
Did it have an effect on you?
I stopped seeking the external for a long time until something happened.
Yeah, what happened?
I came here. We used to come here for Guru Purnima every year. We'd drive these vans down from New York with all these people in it.
I'm losing my voice.
I have a tendency to get emotional too, so don't let me go off the deep end. We would drive down here with vans of people from New York, and one year we had like three. There were so many people that would come and fill up this hall. And he, of course, was here, and people would do these amazing things for it. And I watched him, and he'd come to New York, and I would watch him. I was watching, you know, I didn't have eyes to see pretty well everything. And so I'm watching this being and seeing, okay, here's actually a different kind of a teacher. Everybody knows he looks like that. Yeah, he's casting ideal for a guru. He already looks the part. That was not what I'm talking about. It was, you know, seeing the glow, seeing the way he looked at people, how he made contact with the room full of people. In a really sincere way. It just wasn't done. And then he would talk, and he would talk in a very measured, long, you know, he would take those pauses we talked about. And receive the question. And then offer the answer that was going to be offered. And stuff would flow. So I watched all of that behavior and how people behaved. And also, it occurred to me that all of my other great teachers had these personalities that I came to know that were clear. And his was, I mean, clearly personality. His personality was clear. You know, like I didn't see much. I understood when he would do something that was like, you know, playful or even, I was one of the fortunate ones to receive a reprimand from Gurudev once. And I saw how he did that. I had already seen how he did that. And it would be really, you know, like an archer. It would be well aimed. It would take its mark. And then he would go back into this benign energy that we could call emanating love. And so the whole thing is probably emanating from love, and just another way to show love.
Different aspect of love.
Yes, thank you. So that was what happened, and I watched him. And for years, people were going, you should initiate, you're so integral yoga. And only a few years, because it was in India when I got my intermediate training, and he was over there, that some metaphysical things happened that clearly assuaged all of my fears and pointed the direction that now is the time, and yes, this is the person, you know, don't be afraid. That began that process. Of rubbing and scrubbing me personally through a relationship with a guru. And, you know, it played out. It's still playing out, especially now. Actually, it's much better now. I get the really strong hits. In the beginning, it was things like pranaming him. I had to, as a Westerner, find a way to pranam, because I wasn't going to do that. And it wasn't just as a Westerner with a bunch of European ancestry. I have Cherokee. My great-great-grandmother was full-blooded Cherokee. So I stand on this land, and I'm not going to bow. But I learned, and I gave myself the opportunity, and it took me a long time to actually dandavat pranam. But once that happened, then a whole nother level of that came. And then the real lesson about humility. See, I never had too much humility authentically, because I didn't see examples that warranted it. In my family, outside of my mother, there were instances with people. Of course, people are people. You know, everybody has good and bad. But like really admiring the integrity of somebody when there was all this abuse around all the time. Yeah. So I didn't have a lot of external examples. And even these great teachers, it was like, you know, there's this human aspect. So I was interested in divinity and what that means. And God, I wanted like a yogi. I want that experience. I can't be satisfied with just belief. And I also am not learning now that I can't really completely be satisfied by feeling God either. This is bhakti. For me, it's bhakti. Bhakti takes me to God as a feeling. And I'm here at the heart. And that feels like all those divine qualities are now emanating from me as a feeling. I think that's a human talking. You know, that's a limited. So, I don't know. I want freedom, liberation. I want all that. And when I heard things like within this lifetime, it's reasonable. That's like Shivananda. Yeah, I'm not going to wait. I want to try. And, you know, I've had conversation with people. Are you serious? And all that. I've had a very good time. I'm talking too much. You told me not to talk this much. You're letting me, and I'm not happy. Anyway, yeah, that's what I did. Let's change the topic.
No, I love that topic. I mean, you mentioned not being satisfied with the level of feeling, maybe you're saying?
Uh-huh. With bhakti.
So there's something beyond that?
All right.
Beyond the
maybe
feeling.
I'm Raja Yogi, because as I explored all those religions and didn't find it all, You know, you go through these paths. One is sufficient. I've met Japa yogis that are, you know, they're on their way. And that's all they do. It's really perfectly quick way for a very certain kind of human. You know, we might call it a certain kind of personality trait or whatever that takes you into whatever, which one it is. We understand that. Athletes go into hatha, you know, brainiacs go into yana. Sorry. I have them in my family. Yeah.
So you're saying for you, it's bhakti. Yes. Is that what?
Well, I find myself in the bhakti path now. I was never considered that. That people always thought I was a hatha yogi. And I thought that's ridiculous. Like, I don't even understand the body at all. Just because I can do this stuff doesn't mean I understand getting spiritual lessons from my body. I didn't when he told me that, when I got the Raja Yoga training. And I'm reading the sutras. And so each path is sufficient. Well, how do I get my spiritual lessons from this? Until I did. But at that time, I did not understand that process, as people were calling me this, oh, great, hatha yogi. So I rejected that appellation. Mm. And I thought I was more Raja because I was always interested in meditation first. Mm. But I knew that there was the bhakti because I like ritual. I wanted to be a preacher. Not a preacher, but a pujari, which I ultimately got freedom to do in this organization. And I, you know, sought out training in India. So, yeah, what? Not being, I only just said that. So I'm not quite sure I'm finished with that thought. Mm. What I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Yeah. It means I want that experience, you know, and I've had it. I wonder how much you can have of it and still say, stay sane, or still say operational in the world. You know, so that's where I've been able to balance pretty well, I think, is that I really enjoy life. I'm like Krishna. I'm a supreme enjoyer. I mean, Deepak Chopra said that to me. I came up and he goes, oh, you, why are you in this line to have your book signed? I knew that he didn't. He didn't really like that job. And I brought in a book one time and he was like, why are you? And he said, you really know how to enjoy life, don't you? He was talking about external things, which is what people see, and that's also true. But I also know how to enjoy my life because I decided to. You know, I decided to find happiness at the point when Terry Cole Whitaker said, you can choose emotions to, you know, entertain or think about or explore or be.
So is there a fear that potentially you would not be able to operate on that kind of level anymore if you have so many experiences of, you know, great depth, then something would shift, something would change?
Well, we've seen examples of that. I'm not afraid of that. I still enjoy operating and doing, like, the work that I'm doing with Ramananda in San Francisco is too enjoyable, being here right now. All these ways of serving, when I was trying to be served, you know, for my whole life, I was seeking some answers that I eventually got. And the Yoga Sutra helped shore up the end of that process in that first basic training, was when I really felt like, okay, that explains reincarnation and karma. And that made all the rest of it make sense to me that I hadn't yet figured out, like, why do bad things happen to good people, or, you know, people that do good things? Karma. And reincarnation explains everything else.
And that's connected to humility as well.
What?
Well, to me, karma kind of opens up this door, and it's like my logical mind can't understand why these things are happening. Like, it doesn't make sense. But on the level of karma, you have a feeling that there is a sense to it. It's just beyond what I can see, and may include many lifetimes. Okay. To me, that's humility. It's
not having to figure it out.
Yeah, right.
Like the Yana Yogi that I saw in my sister. She was at the same conference with Deepak Chopra. We went on that together. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting on the floor next to her in Padmasana because I want to be the good yogi, and I was brand new to it. You know, I actually had been taking classes. It was before I found my way to integral yoga. I had declared over there that I wanted to find a new career, and I was propelled into coming to integral yoga. That's a whole nother part of it. But at that conference, I'm sitting there and she's taking these copious notes, and I'm looking at her going, well, you know, can't you just sit for a moment and not have to know everything? And I appreciate now that conundrum, because it does look, in her case and in some, it does look like control and not humility. Mm. Yeah. So you have to have an answer. I'm not safe.
Mm. I think what you just said, though, is an important aspect of it, is to, because maybe that opens the door to compassion. It's safety. That's what's going on here.
Always.
Really? Is it
dissolved
right?
My relationship.
Yeah.
Was not feeling safe. And I told him over and over again, you know, we just need to feel safe. We need to work on this. And it wasn't going to happen. Karma.
Right.
And I had to go through that disillusion as all the things stripped away.
What allows you to feel safe?
And, okay, so what level is that question being answered on? Ask, because, you know, if it's like mundane, what really makes people feel safe, and I would probably feel safer, is if I had a whole lot of money in this society, then you feel like you have some choices and you have sort of a little more command and agency over yourself and your life and the ones that you love and all that. That's why we all are doing this thing. Happiness? What was it? Safety. Yeah. What makes me feel safe? If I feel that I am on purpose, like with the Dharma, and if my seva is being well received, like I'm still at a point now where I need feedback, and that may be getting ready to be over. I hope so. Because I'm an elder, but I'm not a swami, you know? So it's like there's a deference and there's an automatic. And, you know, I just, if I feel like my contribution is worthy and being received, I don't have to be told that I'm the best yoga teacher. I've seen great yoga teachers and been in their classes, you know, and I've taught a pretty good class. But I don't feel responsible for that. I've always said, let the teachings flow through me and let my ego melt with the divine plan. Move aside for now. That's my sankalpa before every class.
Hey.
But saying it is also one thing. Experiencing it is another.
Repeating it over and over and over and over again. I think so much is sankalpa. Yeah. That's why the teachings, repeating it, having a sankalpa, repeating it, applying it to your sadhana. That's why I ask students to make a sankalpa. Consider your sankalpa for your practice right now.
Consider what you want to remember, what you need to remember.
How do you know?
Yeah.
You mentioned having... you know, growing up, having a very advantaged life, and that potentially giving you perspectives that might be different from many people, and also related to the safety. Maybe you've learned the limits of that level of safety.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's that illusion. So while I said that on a mundane level, from the other spiritual level, that's not going to bring me any safety. I mean, my brother told me that a long time ago. I said, you know, I'd like to have a little more financial security in my future as he stopped paying me. Anyway, that's part of that story. All right, so. I hope this has value and purpose for somebody. My grandfather was a very successful chemical engineer who invented a process in New York, and I'm pretty sure they were Jewish, by the way, my grandfather, who moved here and took the Berg off of the last name and just said born, because they were changing, because my great uncles, they moved to Miami. They had the sense of humor. I'm sorry. I tried to bring it up once. They weren't having it because they were turning into a different thing. And they moved out of New York to the middle of the country and reinvented themselves, as he had invented a process for refining crude oil, as Tulsa was the oil boom town of the world at that time before it moved to Houston. And it was a new way of manufacturing heaters to do the catalytic cracking, converting, I think it's called, to its various components. And that's what constitutes the major part of a refinery. Yes, that is my karma from my family. And my grandfather invented it. It was very clever. And it got very successful, and they're sold all over the world. So when I used to go down to that little office in Tulsa, which grew, there was a conference room with a big world map on it, and there were like stick pins. It was heady stuff for a little kid. And I was afforded every opportunity to pretty much have whatever I wanted. And there are two results to that. Either you become really blinded to other people and very insensitive and selfish, or, you know, my reaction was, I don't deserve this. What did I do? I used to ask Terry, I said, well, how can I never did it. She goes, you did something in a past life. It's karma. You know, but I didn't understand karma yet until I got it from the sutras. She was trying to tell me. They did try to tell me, you know, whatever all this benefit that people saw me living. I traveled a lot. I had all this advantage. So the point is that at an early age in my 20s, I remember riding a motorcycle and driving the Mercedes and thinking, this one costs this much and this one costs this much. And this one's like more fun in a way, but at least as much fun as this. And everybody's killing themselves to get this when you can ride a bike for a convertible. You know, it was an awakening to me. And also people would react on this stuff. And I would go, but wait, this is flesh and blood. This is a car. Metal. People would say I'd be in the driver's seat, you know. And my mom would tell me, you're buying these cars. I think that, you know, I'm just worried about the reaction or what you might attract. And I'm very lucky because I was very young and I never got too bad of things happen, too much stolen. Yeah. So there was a certain dissatisfaction with accumulation of wealth, but I was interested in beauty. And a lot of times things that are beautiful cost too. So I started living with beauty and traveling to see beauty. And I studied beauty in college in the form of art history and got a degree just because my dad wanted me to do a degree. So I got one. And then I sold antiques for a while. I moved to New York, and then I became an actor for a while and worked on soaps for a while. And then I was looking for something else to do, and I knew how to cook. So I was a self-taught cook. So I went to culinary school and learned everything else about food, which still serves me to this day, but turned me vegetarian. My first jobs in New York City turned me vegetarian right away. And we were on a path to find ultimate health. And that led me eventually to yoga classes. And they were like, oh, you're so good. You should become a teacher. And that's when I went to India with my sister and made this proclamation over there that when I go back to New York, I'm going to change my career from cooking to something that will actually be beneficial, more beneficial to people in kind of a healing way. I'm not sure. And in front of 500 people, I got up on stage and said something like that. And then that happened. And I came to Integral Yoga, and stepping through those doors, which is in my neighborhood in Greenwich Village in New York, I kind of knew. I didn't really go pursue much else. I had been told a couple other places, which I was familiar with, and I still exposed yoga, went to expose myself to yoga elsewhere. But I was very interested in what I came to know as what the heart of integral yoga might be. From what I understood, it was very inclusive. I'm looking at the yantra, may not be on camera. And that meant everybody.
Whoa.
Yeah. So there are gurus who are for wealthy people, and there are for gurus that are for the, you know, the bad people, the outcasts. You know, there are. And then there are, to me, there's for everybody. So then I had a place here.
And that meant something to you, knowing that that's what integral yoga stands for.
Well, that's what, you know, all along, every time I heard Terry Cole Whitaker speak or Gurudev speak, because they were the two that spoke the best, in my opinion. And every time I heard them speak, I would think, that's it. That's what I always do that, but I could never say that. Mm. Now it's been spoken eloquently to me. I can start to express what I believe or know or felt all along about these topics because I came in this way looking for the truth. And it wasn't until I learned about capital T, you know, there's this ageless, timeless T, truth.
Truth.
You can call it whatever you want. Yeah. Conscience. Again, conscience.
I thought about it recently. It's like, is this the great game that human beings are playing, is searching for the truth?
Yeah. Oh, it takes so long. It takes so long. I want to see you, my Lord, but oh, does it take so long?
Thank you, George Harrison.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not as if we're not seeing the Lord all the time. Yeah. That's what.
Yeah. I don't think we even realize how obsessed we are with the truth. I mean, it's behind everything.
Everything has that. Mm-hmm. Just talking to somebody today about boredom, like life is a series of boredom moments, and you look back at whatever it was, the point was being made, and I looked at my very good close teacher friend and said, I don't believe in boredom anymore because of my advantage background. I know what all that having that stuff is, and it's not. Yeah, it actually does provide a certain amount of happiness. So when they say it doesn't come from external, it does. It just passes. It comes and goes. So if you have the addiction to that, you fulfill that happiness cycle over and over and over again, ad infinitum. And then you learn that it's ultimately not actually that satisfying if you have brains to get to that. You may just end up being unsatisfied and like drink yourself away.
Well, Eric, should we also be aware of that in terms of some spiritual practices, right? Like can that also be the case if it's during meditation or puja where I experience something, I get a high from that. And then when I'm, you know, cleaning or doing the remedial things that I have to do, then that's the low and I'm looking for that. No. Is that still a cycle?
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
No. I mean, yeah, I was, sorry. I was in New York when one of our swamis that's here now came and said, you know, you're not washing the dishes properly. And gave me a lesson in washing the dishes. And I had to humbly receive that. And then think about, wow, so it is now. I mean, we heard Gurudev say, it's all going to turn into sadhana. And so I remember putting a picture outside my bathroom door so that in the morning when I was on the toilet, I would always look over and see Gurudev because it's always good. It's always part of our experience here. None of this, what's natural, is bad. I think I'm, you know, extreme in this. Like I have no problem with people's bodies and everything that goes with that. You know, they talk about that there dawns a certain disgust for the body. because it is a lot of impurity and stuff lives on it, and that's really gross, but it's also natural. So I don't have a problem with it. And death too, like I've been contemplating death for a very, very, very long time. And I just don't think I have a whole lot of fear. There was once when I was incapacitated with an injury and on that medication, that dopey kind of medication that they put people on, that gets you, what, the opioids. Yeah. For a long period of time. And I remember having nightmares that made me think I was clutching for life. In these nightmares, I had nightmares of clutching for life. And it could be visual, like a cliffhanger thing. And I would wake up going, oh, that is the worst feeling. I thought I was done with that because I've been working on it for a very long time to not be fearful and grasping for death, life at death. You know, I looked into Agoris, all that stuff to see the interest in it, the associating yourself with it, the lessons that are there, the Smashantara, you know, the crematoriums and crematorial grounds in India, all that. I exposed myself to a degree, and I met people that did to a much greater degree to learn stuff from. What now I have is pain. Like I have so much pain all the time. I don't want a whole bunch of pain on my way out, you know? And I'm told that that's not always the case. In fact, it's not always often the case. I worked in hospice for a while. I talked to people, and I finally had someone say, no, the preponderance of people go in a kind of a, you know, well, they just go. Yeah, usually at night. And you get incapacitated, you're ill enough, then, yeah, that waking up again and the thing that needs to happen in your heart doesn't happen. So people go. And then I look at what they promised us about guru. So if you self-realize and you practice yoga, you can manipulate the nervous system and your autonomic self, things that you're not supposed to have access to, we learn to have access to. And then it looks to me like if your body is incapacitated and in decrepitude and you're nearing the end of your life, if you're a guru and you start to realize that, it's like, okay, I'm going to drop this now. And you just slow the heart down and let it rest and stay there.
Okay.
That looks good. I like that.
So you mentioned, you know, your experience of meeting Guru Das and a little bit of the impact that it had. And based on what you're saying, it seems that, you know, this external
showed up.
Yeah, back to the external internal, you know, showed up, and that allowed you to reach new levels internally. Is that right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, it's a guru disciple relationship. And
you experienced the power.
I wasn't going to do it.
Yeah.
I wasn't looking anymore.
Yeah.
And then I had these things happen. Metaphysical, which I'll tell you, but I don't talk about it a lot, and maybe not, because we hold those things.
Yeah.
But, you know, all right, I'll just say, he showed up once in the corner of my room in lotus chanting, I pray that your meditations can be as mine. I pray that your meditations can be as mine. So, of course, he's saying that so I can hear it. In my dream awake state in that room in India, but this is what I experienced. And I interpreted that as, first of all, you showed up in my room in a vision. There were multiple ones on that trip. And yeah. It meant that now is the time and this is the person, and you don't really have to be afraid. I didn't want to leave the mantra. Like, you know, why am I changing my mantra? And Mataji, who initiated me in India on that trip, had the interviews with me where I was curious about it, but I wasn't sold because I told her, you know, I have a mantra, I've been using it, and so why am I giving that up? And she said, I often wonder if this was just Gurudev working through her, because to me it didn't really sound like her. I heard, oh, well, if you, after receiving the mantra from Gurudev, if you go through this, you know, if you decide to go through this and if you're accepted and we go through with this, then after receiving the mantra from Gurudev, then, you know, see how that resonates and you can see. And if the other one you want to go back to, then you could just consider that as having been blessed by Gurudev. And again, it's like smack. Okay, that's the last thing you need to hear.
Mm.
Go ahead.
Cool.
And sometimes it's like that. Like, moved to Hawaii was that too. When I moved from New York to Hawaii, I had to get signs over and over again until they were like, you've asked this before. Why do you keep asking us? Yes, now is the time for you to move. Guides.
Do you think you've always looked for those signs in your life?
Mm-hmm. See through the veil?
Yeah. So you've never been more of one to like figure it all out in your mind. It's always been more of like, allow the universe to tell me what to do.
Yeah, I have a visual and an oral. You know, yeah. I think that things can be seen that aren't there, and I think things can be heard that aren't there. Yeah, in the form of lessons or experience. For example, okay, since I'm a child of that era, I didn't have a whole lot of experience with it. But when I took lysergic diethylamphetamine acid, whatever that's called, LSD, in high school, it gave me experiences that I didn't know the mind was capable of. So when I started seeing things like that in hallucination, or when I started feeling things like that, it was really seeing and feeling an altered state. I came back from that experience going, not like, oh, I want more of that, you know, or how, not particularly how great that was. It was super powerful. So, but what I came away from it with was, oh, the mind's capable of that. Isn't that interesting? The mind is capable of that. And as I learned later from Deepak Chopra, the body has the chemicals in it already to make your pharmacy. If you knew how to concoct within your own body, you could remedy yourself. That's a scientific thing he was trying to purport. You know, we don't have the consciousness yet to be able to manipulate what we could potentially.
It's there.
Our own systems. And yoga is teaching us, you know, expanding horizons with that, isn't it?
You ever consider that maybe it's important to remember how much better it is now than it used to be? Like, how much better it's gotten?
Yeah, because I get negative. You may not see that in me, but I have such a negative bent from just being in my brain. And seeing, like, you know, really, gosh, do you have to treat these black people? Do you have to treat these Indians in my class like that? Like, I'm going to be your friend, because that's not right. And I'm 5 years old. So, yeah, I've been disappointed by my species for a very long time. And I have to love my species. I'm that. There's no difference. It's not like I'm not participating in the same ills and evils. But it's been hard to stay positive, what you just said. And that's why when I heard Gurudev at the end of all of this trying to talk about 9/11 or what all the stuff that's going on, nuclear, you know, the fears that we live through with him helping us, he would say, I think things are getting better. Mm. In the end, it would be, but I see a future that, you know, and look to Satya Yuga if you want. I don't see that it's getting better right now, except that in a lot of ways it is. Yeah.
Like how can our minds even know that?
Right.
Right. Like it's
what's better.
Yeah.
And what's better?
Like,
exactly.
Do you really think that
what's like, supposed to be like what?
I often feel like because our minds are capable of so much and they're so amazing, the delusion often is that they can understand it, everything and anything. Hopefully. And a question like that. Yeah. To make these assessments of like it's getting better or worse.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. That's my answer to your question. Is I'm confounded as to what that means.
Yeah.
Better or worse.
Well, the level of better, I guess I meant it back to the internal, external, right? We kind of get caught, especially external, like I can't know that. But internally, based on the yoga practices, at least for me, I mean, very objectively speaking, I could say that the experiences I have day to day now are much more peaceful, much
this
more
is
relaxed.
What you're talking about.
Yeah. Oh. Than the way, like the anxiety and the stress that I used to experience.
Yes. My life was saved.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I was not finding that health. We were looking for it, but. You know, I was living in New York, and it was the 80s and 90s, please. I was having a whole lot of fun. And I would have to restore and recuperate from that kind of fun. And I just was wondering why I had to put myself through so much to try to find this temporary satisfaction. That occurred to me in New York a lot. Like, I just saw how much energy I was putting into getting myself ready and getting out the door and going somewhere and then spending time there and not wanting to really be there anyway because it's that kind of environment to try to meet somebody and which was ultimately unsatisfying. And I just judged that whole experience. Yeah, not satisfying. Still looking for it outside.
Yeah.
But also being ruled by natural functions of the human mortal coil that we're bound into, that, you know, I can speak to an insatiable lust that was so unsatisfying. And thank God I didn't have that many opportunities. I had lots of rejection, which was a whole nother experience. But I could have been easily dead like everybody else I know from AIDS at that time. That was a whole nother lesson. Everybody in my generation dropped off, especially the, you know, brighter ones that were out there, the, you know, kind of stars of that era, the people, the movers and shakers, the ones that were making things happen, that made Miami happen. Those investment people from my gay community in New York moved there. I saw it. It was in complete disarray. And they said, we're going to do this. Now Miami.
Okay.
I don't know how I got off on that tangent, but yeah, we were talking about external and internal and better and worse. I would say, yes, I would like to speak just a second, which is that in my personality story line, yes, the reactivity, the catching the mind, and then wanting, this is what we're working on. Let's talk about what we're inspired by now. What we've been working on in San Francisco through Amananda's spearheading us, among other things, is compassionate communication and dealing with each other in the house because we're tight. You know, we have all of your community is beautifully spread out, and we are in this with tight little rooms and on top of each other and literally in each other's bathrooms. You'd have that here. But I had never lived in that before. And he told me, you're going to have all this additional rubbing and scrubbing. I said, no, it's going to be good for me. I know that. It's fine. And then it happened, and it was very, very, very hard. And I found myself saying things to people that, you know, I would be driven to something and they'd be shocked by what I'd say to them. I'd say, yeah, I've tried everything else. Now, does that get your attention? I'm coming to that level to try to see if I can make you stop talking or me I'd like to stop. Yeah, I was ready. So that kind of confrontational thing now was what I'm interested through his spearheading. So as we were talking about compassionate communication, how we deal with each other, because primarily I was having major difficulties with certain people and not feeling like it was just all about me. I'm sorry, but I don't take full responsibility for all that. But it was very uncomfortable, and I wanted to find a way. And it has to do with that staying in the heart, too. Because I would go up to my room, I would practice sadhana in the form of the chalisa with another group of people, and I would immediately drop from my head into my heart, and I would feel so much love in my room for everything, because I had just had communion with Hanuman and Ram. It was amazing, and it was real. It was absolutely real for me. And I would come down the stairs, and somebody would say something that indicated that the world doesn't necessarily want to receive your rosy outlook heart, open heart right now. And usually that's going to be the case almost. You know, people say they want that, but yeah, when you see it, you don't believe it like that. So I had to find a way to stay in there, and that coincided with non-reactive mind taking hold in more serious, deep, regular sadhana. And this questioning of how to deal with people when it comes up. So my insight is everybody wants to go away. And when you're ready, we'll talk about it. But when you're ready, never happens. So I want to talk about it actually as it's happening, because people aren't aware that it's even happening until somebody is.
What is happening?
These egos are battling. It's just an ego battle.
Competition.
Yeah. So can I get outside that and see? And that's easy for me. Like I said, I can see it. So from that spiritual eye, I'm seeing, oh, Snehan, poor thing. You're not being heard. You need to do, you better defend yourself. I mean, that may not be my spiritual self, but you know, you got to, you don't need to be treated like this because of my background, all that. My little buttons are being pushed here. And then the other person is doing the same thing. But that doesn't help for me to have that other than help me. It helps me disassociate, have a moment of grace. The more I can connect to that, the more I can actually see and then choose. These are basic, you know, yoga teachings. Then we choose. What I want to choose now is to stay in the heart. Why? So it's the sankalpa. I'm choosing now to come down out of my room and see. As I'm challenged, I'm going to still stay here, regardless of you don't want to see it. I won't show it to you, but I'm going to stay here. Because when the other comes up and I come back up here and get critical, it doesn't feel nearly as good. Compare the two feelings. Like, the choice is easy for me. So it's not easy to do or affect, but it's easy to make. I want that. So now I have a sankalpa to stay in my heart. Now, how am I going to do that? I'm going to start watching when the challenges come, and the big ones are big, you know. Instead of reacting here, can I find a way? And we worked on this. I heard Ramananda talk about it, and I worked on it. I mean, I've done it with him. I had some of my biggest lessons with him. Finding a way to be in censure and allow that to be correct. Actually, what you're saying about me is completely incorrect in my storyline, but it is correct in your storyline. So let that be correct. Can I authenticate that that's correct for you in my essence of not being resistance, but allowing you to be correct in your assessment of me? Now, let me see if I can explain to you why I have another assessment of me. Usually people don't want to hear it, but you're already started the process of, I'm open to hearing about what you're talking about me, you know, and I want to hear that. So I'm listening to you now. Can you elucidate that to me? Can you say that again? So you give the person a chance to have non-resistance. That opens a door. And usually they'll come down there with you to the heart. and you're able to hear them. But once they're done professing, often they're gone and thank you and bye. But, oh, wait, I didn't get a chance to. So can I still stay in my heart for the one that leaves instead of commanding, wait, you didn't listen, which I used to do. I probably won't do that next time. Why do I have to prove I'm right? I'm not right. Who's right? You know?
That's not so strong. Proving that you're right.
Oh my God,
how strong is that
for everybody? Yes, including me. But I'm watching it now because I know this holistic view. You know, the apple is beautiful apple sitting here. It looks edible to you, but it looks rotten to me. You can't see the rotten part. But I do. Who's right?
So fighting about reality.
Yeah. Or what this country means, or religions. You know, fighting about what this country means. I don't know the answer to that, by the way. And I didn't understand the essence of boundaries for a long time. I'm like the hippie era. Like, we don't have to have police. We don't have to have government. We don't have to have countries. Why can't we all just live? People are the same. And I went to Russia and saw people are the same in many ways, the essential, like, you know, the lower nature ways. You have to have these things taken care of. But then these egos and are smarter than we have the capacity for brains. That's our problem, is our technologies are way over our capacity to healthily deal with them. It's been this way for a while. So as whatever gods may be watching us play this out, careful, kids.
Listen. What a trip.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing so openly. I can feel the depth of the experience that you've had in this life.
Thank you.
Is there anything else you'd like to share?
I was just wondering if we were about done. So I feel so grateful and honored, truly, apart from whoever else might ever hear this. I am not even thinking about that. It's been a great little conversation with you. I hope I haven't overstepped anybody's bounds. I hope anything that I said that offended anybody, I'm sorry, that's not the intent. And I'm receiving so much more love than ever. And I have been such a needy vessel. That it's interesting to see it really starting to overflow more and more.
Yeah. I'm so happy to hear that.
Jai.
Om Shanti.
Jai Guru.
Thank you, Sam.
Okay. Om Shanti. Thank you, Avi.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed this content and think others might as well, please feel free to share and subscribe.